This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday. Matt and Patrick here today. How are you today, Patrick?
Doing great. How are you?
All right. Do you wear glasses at all?
I probably should, but I don't.
I had to start wearing them because all of a sudden I was driving down the road and I could not read signs. You know that it was getting pretty bad. So a few years ago, I went and got glasses, and they've been great. When I had my health issues early this year, one of the things that was really interesting is how the many auxiliary problems they created for me. And one of them was my eyesight got worse. And so I had to go in today. And there is, if you go in there, and I'm not sure what the test is, but if you go to, go in and they'll check your eyes. And of course, they put the thing up against your face. And does this look better? Or does this look better? That sort of thing. But they put this in your eyes. And then they use some other drops. And you are susceptible to brightness for a while. You can, I mean, frankly, it's hard to be with any lights on at all. It really is bright. And I, you know, so like just walking out of the eye clinic and back to my car, I'm like, I barely see. It finally is clearing up though, I think. I mean, yeah, you don't look too much. It actually does look like Patrick in the other studio. It doesn't, it's not necessarily just a completely unrecognizable blob or anything.
Does it make you wish you couldn't see having to look at me?
I like you, Patrick. You're good people, man. I missed you. I mean, it's nice to have you back. It's not that, dear God, man, Patrick is actually one of the hardest workers here at the station. Really busts his caboose, and you deserve that vacation time. I'm glad you got the time off, but it's nice to have you back. That's for sure.
Thank you. I really do appreciate that.
How old, I'm not supposed to ask this because HR will get me in trouble. How old are you?
I'm 31.
31. How much do you remember about 9/11?
I actually do remember some pretty concrete details about it.
And where were you in school at that point?
I was in fifth grade. I was at Otter Lake Elementary School, which is north of White Bear Lake.
Were you actually in class? I mean, that happened at, it started happening at 8 a.m, happened throughout the morning. Were you, when the first time you heard it, were you sitting in a classroom?
I hadn't heard about it. I walked into the classroom. I don't know if I was perceiving the tension of people around me, but I could feel something was wrong. I did not know anything about, but just kind of, so my dad dropped me off at school, must have been about 7:30 that morning. Okay. And just, I was going, having the school breakfast, and I just had this feeling that something was not right. Mm-hmm. And, like I said, I don't know if I could pick up the tension of people who were starting to become aware that this had happened. And, I don't know. But first time I knew something was actually wrong, I walked into the classroom. I looked up at the TV, which was turned on. This wasn't unusual. My fifth grade teacher watched a lot of TV. And I look up at the TV, it's on CNN, and it says explosion on Capitol Hill. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, at that point, I think they didn't quite know what had happened. It just said explosion. I don't think they had a, but that was the first time that I go, oh, that's not a good thing.
When I was a kid, I remember Nixon's resignation. I mean, I'm 52, I turned 53 in October. And I was born in 68. I remember it. That was probably the first thing I remember watching on television. I don't remember the moon landing. I was too young. But I remember everyone watching the news coverage of Nixon resigning. I also then remember being at our cabin in northern Minnesota. And we had a TV up there, but my dad never let us turn the TV on when we went up there. I mean, that was just not allowed. And all of a sudden in 1976, with the Olympics in Montreal, We were able to turn on the TV and watch the Olympics there, which was really kind of cool. That was I thought that was a lot of fun to do that. It kind of got me into the Olympics, why I kind of watched the Olympics with my kids. You know, the technology, it was interesting back then because I did have we had just bought my house in Hopkins just a few months earlier. My son was due to be born in about a month and a half. You know, the 20-year-old who's at college now. Soon to be 20-year-old. And we'd set up a computer there, and I was doing some research. At that point, I was filling in on Metro Traffic. I had filled in on some of the other radio stations in the town. I'd done some stuff at KFAN and stuff. I had just moved back to the Twin Cities about a year and a half earlier, and so I'm kind of just getting settled back in. And so I basically I'm just doing some filling, but I was kind of amazed by the internet because it was kind of one of those things where you could see the beginnings of it. It wasn't universal. I mean, there was a lot of news outlets at that point that weren't online. There were some. I mean, ESPN, you'd go there, you see ESPN. Some of the news sites were online. To give you an idea, if you wanted kind of breaking news, I was listening to one of the radio stations in town. I can't remember which one it was. And then when the things happened, I went down and started to turn on the TV. That's where you saw breaking news, as opposed to today, which it's everyone staring at their phone. As a matter of fact, it was kind of interesting. I remember calling my wife and having to explain, do you know what's going on? And she's like, no. I said, well, we're under attack. And she, you know, this is in the day. There was internet, there were computers, but it was still before the smartphone and the constant news updates and news banners that you would get on your phone, the constant alerts that you would get telling you what's going on. It was well before that. And so, you know, there was that going on. I remember the radios guy talking just after the first person came in, but it was kind of joking, like, some idiot flew his plane into one of the World Trade Centers. Oh, my gosh. Wacky morning zoo time. And I will not forget the moment that he all of a sudden changed and said, oh, my God, another plane flew into one of the buildings, and it looks like that plane intentionally flew into the building. And I've said to my kids, I said, there was a moment on 9/11 where things just changed. There was a moment before that time and after that time. There are still a lot of people after the first plane flew into the building that thought, is this an accident? Was this a mistake? But the second plane flying in, pretty much while everyone was watching, that's that moment when things changed. That the realization of, oh, this is not just some nutball pilot that lost control. This is actually something far more nefarious and serious, and we have to pay attention to it. We were unified. Oh, God. I mean, one of the things which is interesting about looking back on that time is this country wasn't very unified before that. Gore v. Bush had left a lot of raw feelings, especially since a lot of the stories leading up to 9/11 were how if Gore would have recounted the entire state of Florida, he would have won. And people were kind of asking, and of course you had Enron too, which was a wild story. And then of course, just the incompetence of Bush and kind of his administration, they couldn't get out of their own way. And it really was not a great administration. It was a really bad start to his administration, and he wasn't a great president anyway, but and very arguably the worst two-term president we've ever had. But in the moments after that, the country for the most part came together, and we had at least for a few months some a kind of a thing of beauty that we haven't seen as Americans in a long time. Now, and I'm saying there wasn't racist jerks out there, saying attack all Muslims. I mean, that was half there. The Dixie Chicks, for goodness sakes. You did have some Republican pundits at the point in time screaming, this is all Bill Clinton's fault. You did have some of that. But for the most part, I mean, it was minuscule compared to mainly everyone just saying, we're in this together. Let's come together as a country. A lot of that changed. And one of the things that you go through the just when all of a sudden, the attacks on the attacks on Muslims. The reality that Bush was defending the Saudis for some reason. Cheney basically yanking the troops out of Afghanistan and bin Laden. We forget about that little gem, is that bin Laden was still alive and in Tora Bora, and the Taliban was still going. We could have won both that entire conflict completely at that point, but Dick Cheney wanted to flood the OPEC world, the oil markets, with Iraqi oil and kill off OPEC. And so that was the whole goal behind Iraq. So an unjustified war that killed thousands of American soldiers. You have the reveal that, oh, yeah, bin Laden determined to strike in the United States. You have that happen. Everyone going like, uh-oh. You have the Bush administration officials appearing before Congress and just making the determination, I'm going to sound like a complete moron as opposed to tell the truth, because that's actually a better plan for me. But there was something subtle that happened late in W's second term, which kind of not only ended the unification of Americans, but it kind of annihilated the potential of us doing that again. And it was something subtle, and I do believe this is kind of the beginning of it, how conservatives started framing 9/11 in 2005, 2006. It was much more about, well, that plane crash in Pennsylvania, and of course they attacked the military. And you're like, well, yeah, of course they attacked the Pentagon, and United 93, of course, crashed in the Pennsylvania field. But you remember the World Trade Center towers, right? They got taken out too. Oh, yeah. I'm not trying to dismiss them, but, you know, really, come on, you know, Pennsylvania and the Pentagon. And I would go back and talk to them, and they that was kind of the same narrative. There was a changing of how they wanted to frame 9/11. And that really came across really strong when the same people started throwing around the idea that 9/11 was really an attack on real America. That was about 2006, 2007, May 2007, you started hearing the term real America was attacked on 9/11. When you'd ask them what real America was, the response was, well, it's part of this country where wholesome family values, love of God, and clean and honest quality of life exists, not the corrupted, dirty, and ungrateful areas of this country that try to take advantage of real Americans. Yeah, pretty big dog whistle. Yeah, it was kind of, they weren't trying to hide it. And when you got into the 2008 election, they didn't even try to hide it at all. They got rid of that thin veil, and the argument morphed into the very blunt, real America versus the liberal anti-American parts of the country. Point out to these people that were saying this, that the vast majority of victims of 9/11 were supposed, that these people are attacking, were from the liberal anti-American parts of the country they claimed were evil, but they just kind of ignore me, insisting 9/11 was really a direct attack on Republicans and their values, an attack which liberals cheered. That was the beginning of it. That was the beginning. And you put this in conjunction with the fact that Dick Cheney in 2004 and Karl Rove, to win that election in 2004 against John Kerry, had to welcome to the table the extremists on the far right, because they had lost the blue-collar worker at that point, were not going to get reelected, and so they had to go on out and get the religious extremist. They had to go get the racist. They had to get the nutbags on the compounds out in Montana. And they, you know, they had to get the people that were conspiracy theory loonballs. And they brought them on in and let them have a seat at the table in 2004. By the time you get to 2008 and Sarah Palin, you can see where this is going. That was just the beginning. Now, look, think about that. How they started changing the narrative that 9/11 was really something the liberals cheered for, and it was attack on us, just part of the United States. And look where we're at today. You know, on one side, people begging people to get vaccinated, wear a mask, be as safe as possible as we're dealing with a major pandemic, because people don't want you dying. On the other side, the argument is, you're lying. There's nothing to worry about. Let me take my horse dewormer that can kill me. We're for personal responsibility. But then if after one of their loved ones gets infected or they get infected with COVID, the argument is, I'm a victim. Biden did this to me. I'm a victim. That's how these people are. The main change in this country over the last 20 years is how one political party, the Republicans, decided to blame the worst things that have happened to us as a country on their political opponents to get what they wanted. Even when they couldn't find enough real things to blame Democrats for, they just started making crazy stuff up, like pizza parlor sacrifice pits and magnetized vaccines and stolen elections. The reason we are no longer unified as a country is because one side has blamed the other for everything bad this country has experienced, not because it's true, but because it's a political opportunity. They created a villain their followers easily and eagerly embraced, enabling the politicians to push through an insanely conservative political agenda. And that's where we're at. This last 20 years, if you were to say what would signify to you what happened over this 20 years, is we started with 9/11 and a unified country for the most part after 9/11, and we've become this party that if 9/11 happened today, there would be no unification, even for a second. Republicans would be screaming heads, "It's all the Democrats' fault," as they sent out fundraising emails. That is what has happened. You have gotten to the point now where, and the funny thing is, it's whatever happened to unity? Ever have a conservative ask about that? Talk about, well, you guys basically went out back and shot it in the head. That's what you guys did. And buried it in a shallow grave. And you dance on that grave on a daily basis. So don't ask me about where did unity and civility come from. For goodness sakes, you guys basically, every time you want to get something done, whether it's Ebola, whether it's, you know, pandemic, which there's a reason why Trump became your god, because in this psychology that we're in today, in the post 9/11 world, where the Republicans basically have anything bad that happens, it rains when you're at a picnic, it's the Democrats' fault. Trump is your golden idol. He is the golden calf himself. The guy you worship, because that is exactly what you would expect that party to get to, considering the path they have been on. That is a guy that's just, they're just horrible people. Oh, you know, I signed the paperwork to get us out of Afghanistan. Didn't I go to do a good job? Oh, it's going bad. Oh, I didn't do that. That was all Biden. That was Biden did it. I could beat him up in a boxing match. For God's sakes, Trump just said that he could beat up Joe Biden. This is a former president talking about the current president in a boxing match. For the record, Biden would whip that fat boy's ass. That's a reality. That is a reality. Biden would beat, they would call that within about a minute of the first round. But that being said, that's where you're at. 9/11 was not the beginning of a unification of this country. It was the beginning of blaming one party, the Republicans, blaming the Democrats for everything bad that did happen in this country as a way to push their political agenda forward. And the fact is that since 2004, when they welcomed in the loon balls into the Republican Party, the people that vote Republican have gobbled it up. Sure, I'll blame them for Comet Pizza sex rings and the latest QAnon conspiracy theory. As they jam horse dewormer in their bodies because they think science. Tomorrow, the Friday link tonight is going to be the movie from the French guys that were following the fire department that is truly heartbreaking to watch. But the reality is that it's a good reminder of what we had at that point. We were unified. We were together as a country. It is going to be a generation before we're like that again, at best. But right now, I see one political party on a suicide run that will never turn away from their never-ending drive for that cliff. Republicans just enjoy saying Democrats are evil too much. That is just who they are. So in the next 20 years, maybe we can fix this problem. But remember, when your Republican friends say, "Why aren't we unified tomorrow?" you say, "Well, because you went out back and said, shot the unification in the head and buried it in a shallow grave and dance on it on a daily basis. Because you blame Democrats for everything that's happened in this country." Fact. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. When we do return, a lot to get to with the Minnesota coronavirus update. A lot of interviews coming up in the 5 o'clock hour, too. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show, 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Let's get into the coronavirus update. Actually, let me remind you. I mean, we got a chock full show today. I mean, it is in the 5 o'clock hour. Max Richmond is going to join us. He's from the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. He's going to talk the latest report on funding of both programs and infrastructure bill. Of course, that's the extended interview that we do with Brett Johnson on Fridays. And then Bakken is going to join us. Greg Bakken what's the Ghost Box Radio guys? The Ghost Box Radio guys. We've had him on before. I'm going to ask him about my ghost tours in the South. I've got to talk to him about that. Also, I might ask him, do toasters really have ghosts associated with it? I don't think that that's real. But he's got an amazing guest that was part of 9/11 and was one of the more revered sites. And he'll talk a little bit about what they're going to be talking about on his show this weekend. So that's coming up here in the 5 o'clock hour. 952-946-6205. Plus, I'm going to dance. Why not? It's a Friday. Friday's COVID-19 update from the Minnesota Department of Health includes 2,050 new cases, 18 newly reported, 18 of them. 13 of the 18 deaths happened in September. The other five, apparently it's one for each month, March, April, May, June, and August, where they were relabeled. Now, the August death could have been someone that went in and they died recently within this wave, but the other ones are generally people who died that the official cause of death has now been determined. The state's death toll is 7,892 since the start of this pandemic. As of September 7th, the state reported that 3,348,641 people have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, while 3,158,635 people have completed their vaccine series. Through September 9th, the number of people with COVID-19 and hospitalized in Minnesota was 695. That's up from 669 reported on Thursday. Of those hospitalized, 185 people are in intensive care, 510 in general hospital care. Now, we are getting close to these, and one of the things that they've been talking about is the spring surges as a way to compare how bad this is getting. Well, I think that there's a legitimate chance by next week we could be into past what we had in the spring. Because the path of personal responsibility sucks at stopping the spread of COVID. It's not doing it. They keep screaming about personal responsibility. You guys aren't responsible personally. That's it. You just don't have any personal responsibility. So having personal responsibility means you have people that are personally responsible, and that just doesn't exist. 185 people. The spring surge saw 202. So we are 17 away from having more than the spring surge. The 510 in general hospital care are 7 behind the general hospital care from the spring surge, said the intensive, the just people in the regular hospital. And right now, I don't see any signs that this is turning around. I mean, like I said, today's numbers are 2,000 new sick people. 2,000. That is by far the largest number we've had. The 2,050 positive results on Friday's update were from 40,472 completed tests. The positivity rate, 5.06. John Hopkins' positivity rate over the past 7 days is 7.41%, which is way beyond the 5% threshold for safety. But I don't know. I got a story here. Jensen's out there making insane, stupid grunting noises again. But, and there's political motivations for him. I'll get to that here in a second. But, when I talk about the when Republicans turned everything into, it's the Democrats' fault. The fact that we are here, one of the reasons we are here is because of this intentional ignorance. It's the drunk guy in the bar who's taken a bet that he can hit his hand with a ball peen hammer on the bar and he'll be fine. And you look at him and say, dude, man, don't do that. You're going to really hurt yourself. And he's like, I'm going to show you. Whack. Ow! I've hurt my hand. And 2 years later, when he's still having health hand issues because of whacking his own hand with a ball peen hammer, he still can't come to grips that he is responsible for his own actions. He still sits there and is like, you should have tried harder to stop me. You knew that was going to hurt, and you didn't stop me. Yeah. That is where we're at, because they live in that fantasy world where they are wholesome and righteous, and the Democrats are evil. And so if the Democrats say, get vaccinated, wear a mask, don't die, don't get sick, they hear that and say, we'll show you. Give me that ball-peen hammer. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. The only bout to sanity in this Twin Cities some days, isn't it? It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show, once again on your Friday. Native Roots Radio coming in here at 6 o'clock. Make sure you stay with us through the evening right here on AM 950. Just after 2 weeks since the Minnesota State Fair started, and only 4 days since it ended, the Minnesota Department of Health has confirmed 69 cases of COVID-19 that were likely contracted at the Great Minnesota Get-Together. The cases are in people who reported attending the fair during a period in which they were most likely exposed and infected. Minnesota Department of Health spokesperson Doug Schultz informed Bring Me the News on Friday, we expect the number of cases associated with the fair to increase in the coming days as the fair ended just this last Monday. Vaccines and masks were not required at the fair, though both were strongly encouraged. Hey, how's that personal responsibility stuff working out for you? It doesn't work at all? Oh, great. Hey, but still keep thinking to yourself you're doing something when you sit there. We're going to put out a strongly worded memo encouraging people to get masks on. Yeah. You got to mandate it. And that's what you have to do. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have been encouraging outdoor mask wearing at crowded events due to transmissibility of the Delta variant on the coronavirus. Speaking on Thursday, Minnesota Department of Health Infectious Disease Director Chris Ayersman said that there are three generations of transmissions, and the original coronavirus strain would typically infect approximately 27 people, while the Delta variant spread is to an estimated 343 people in three generations of transmission. When going out in the public, the best way to reduce your risk and prevent spread to others is to get vaccinated, wear a mask, and social distance, said Schultz, in order to limit continued spread. Minnesotans should get tested 3 to 5 days after attending large gatherings. The 2021 Minnesota State Fair saw its lowest total attendance figure since 1977, with a total of only 1,301,584 attendees over the 12-day event. That figure is down about 36% from the average attendance over the previous four fairs. Concerns over the Delta variant, coupled with the fair's decision to not require masks and proof of vaccination, resulted in some entertainment acts, vendors, booth operators, and Minnesota residents opting out of this year's get-together. I didn't go. I remember I talked about that. I was thinking about, do I make a run in there and get the certain foods I want and leave? And the decision was, it's not worth it. And here's the one thing that I think is just a real crime about these numbers, is that we won't know these numbers because the amount of people who are not maskers, who right now are sick as a dog, that know that likely they picked this up at the state fair, those people are going to refuse to answer any kind of tracking questions about where do you think you got it, or even go to the freaking doctor until they have to go to the emergency room. Because they're so determined to basically, if I say anything, the Democrats win. God forbid we actually have some idea how we're fighting this. God forbid. But if you are sick, for God's sakes, go to the hospital. Get checked out. Don't sit and wait. I mean, for God's sakes, one of the reasons why most of the people, what is it? I saw the case. It's of the people who are dying right now. Clearly, it's like 9 out of 10 for sure. It's probably, it's probably worse ratios are unvaccinated. One of the things they say is that if you don't go in the minute you start feeling sick, the likelihood of you having a severe case increases. It becomes, then you start getting pneumonia involved. And for God's sakes, go get checked out. I mean, this is just, it feels like I'm in a different plane of reality. For God's sakes, if you're sick, go to the doctor. I'm not going anywhere, even though I feel horrible. Because if I do, and they say I got COVID, then Matt McNeil wins. Dude, I don't care. Just, you don't have to tell anyone. just go get checked out. I don't want you sick. I don't want you dead. And I don't want you bankrupt for the next 10 years of your life, okay? Please. Just go get checked out. Get vaccinated. Wear a damn mask, people. By the way, fine for violating federal mask mandates going up. The Transportation Safety Administration on Thursday announced the fine for people who refuse to wear a mask at airports, on commercial aircraft, on buses, and on trains has increased from $500 to $1,000 for the first offense. The original fee was $250. So now it's $500 to $1,000 depending on the first offense. So you could get $500 now, or you get $1,000. My guess is going to be $1,000. Repeat offenders face a fine of $1,000 to $3,000. Wow. TSA will double the fines for travelers that refuse to wear a mask. President Biden on Thursday, while appearing at a slew of other actions his administration has taken to combat the spread of COVID-19. If you break the rules, be prepared to pay. And by the way, show some respect. The TSA, and you should. TSA issued a federal mask mandate for transportation on February 2nd, recently extended to January 18th in an effort to combat the COVID pandemic. Wearing a mask protects the traveling public and all the personnel who make traveling experience safe, secure, and comfortable. Secretary of Homeland Security Mayorkas said in a statement, "We'll continue to enforce the mask mandate as long as necessary to protect public health and safety." Oh, yeah. Well, here you go. I, of course, refer to this next guy as the witch doctor. Now, sure, it could be, you know, someone could listen to that and say, God, man, it makes it sound like you're mocking his medical experience, calling him the witch doctor. It actually refers to, which doctor are we going to see today? Are we going to see the guy that's actually been to medical school? Or are we going to see the far-right loon ball who's basically saying anything to get Republicans to vote for him? Well, today it's the latter. Witch doctor. Dr. Scott Jensen, Republican gubernatorial candidate, calling for civil disobedience among Minnesotans and businesses in the state, asking them to ignore vaccine and mask guidelines intended to stem the spread of COVID-19. Okay, let me talk about this crotch clown here. That dude, what are you freaking doing? You do understand someone is going to listen to you, and God forbid, goes into a school and shoots someone or does this, and they say, I'm here to participate in civil disobedience. God forbid. And you can sit there all day long and say, I'm not calling for violence. I'm not calling for anyone to be, shooting anyone. But dude, you are basically throwing rocks at the beehive at this point. And the last I checked, the bees don't have an organized response when you do that. They just sting. God forbid someone actually does take this clown up on his ideas. Because can you imagine? Oh my God. He's actually calling for people to be civil disobedient in this case. And God forbid something does happen. I can see Jensen coming out like, oh, I don't know where you get the idea that when I said, they're going to kill your grandmother, that I was saying that people should go on out there and do violent things. I mean, I was just saying, they're going to come and take your kids and kill them. Ah! But you somehow interpreted that as me encouraging violence. Paraphrasing. Patrick, make sure we record this part. Paraphrasing. But I'm not too far off, am I, Dr. Jensen? The witch doctor. I'm not too far off, am I? But I'm paraphrasing. Jensen Ichaska, family physician, and former state senator, released a YouTube video Friday announcing he was drafting language for a proposed bill to make Minnesota a healthy freedom sanctuary state after President Joe Biden said he would use his executive power to sidestep GOP governors, resisting his call for new federal vaccine requirements. Wow. I am calling on all citizens to stand up, especially I'm calling on my Republican colleagues to stand up and declare where you're on this, Jensen said. Enough is enough. Let's meet this moment. Dear Lord. Like I said, paraphrasing. A little. In an interview Friday, Jensen then he was working with lawmakers in both the state and House Senate to, on the proposal, but declined to identify them until the bill is complete. With the Delta variant of the coronavirus still surging, the president this week announced new federal vaccine requirements that could affect 100 million Americans. Biden criticized Republican governors and unvaccinated idiots, I mean citizens, for setting back the nation's efforts on slowing down the pandemic, which they have. The reason why we are having this current outbreak is because of purposely because of Republican ignorance. And they'll when eventually they kill off enough of their own citizens and the numbers start going down, they'll say, see, thank God we did it my way. Oh, God. I mean, these people are killing their own citizens, sickening their own citizens out of spite. And that's it. Like I said, this is the fallout of when they started basically saying, Democrats do everything wrong. This is where you get. You get Scott Jensen. Minnesota Republicans reacted with outrage over Biden's new mandates on Friday with newly elected Senate Majority Leader Jeremy Miller calling them simply ridiculous and unreasonable. Reminder, the Minnesota Republicans, the Minnesota GOP in the Senate last year after the election had a big party where they seemed to throw aside safety protocols in regards to dealing with the pandemic. Created a super spreader event within the GOP Senate caucus. Likely killed one of their own senators in said outbreak. And then, funny story, went back to work and only the day that the Democrats showed up decided to tell the Democrats, hey, by the way, we have a whole bunch of people sick as a dog with COVID. I know. You and your entire caucus, Jeremy, Skim Milk, dude, you guys can shut up. You have no ability to criticize anyone in regards to COVID response. The campaign for Neil Shah, who is also a doctor and a GOP candidate for governor, meanwhile, sent a fundraising pitch on Friday assailing Biden's mandates and vowing to not back down from personal freedom no matter what Joe Biden thinks he can order us to put into our bodies. Jensen, one of the few first entrants into the 2022 race, has focused his campaign almost exclusively on opposition to Governor Tim Walz's response to COVID-19. Jensen's campaign page has been banned from advertising on Facebook after the social media giant concluded that it was repeatedly posted content that's been debunked by third-party fact-checkers. TikTok also banned Jensen for his mismanagement on COVID-19 protocols. Earlier this year, Jensen also joined a federal lawsuit seeking to halt COVID-19 vaccinations for children. It was filed by a group whose founder participated in the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Jensen said that he has not been vaccinated and has no plans on doing so. He's already contracted the virus and has sufficient antibodies, which he says is superior to what we're getting with vaccines. There is no scientific reason for me to get that vaccine, Jensen says. Wow. Wow. It is terrifying that this is a guy. What he is saying is, even though we know, and we do, I mean, even if you were just a belligerent moron and you still said to yourself at the beginning of summer, you know what? I still don't know if vaccines work. I still don't know if masks works. What we have had play out in this country is states like Texas and Missouri and Florida and Alabama and Mississippi and Idaho, where Republicans have basically said, no masks, we're going to discourage you to get vaccinated, and we're going to open everything up. And we'll just say personal responsibility. And of course, they do that fake line at the end of it. It's like, well, we kind of encourage you to get vaccinated and get a mask. But this is after they say, those namby-pamby people, they want you to wear a mask. I'm against that. Oh, you probably should. But I'm going to mock it as unnecessary. I mean, clearly. And you are a doctor of medicine. I don't know. Is the witch doctor a doctor of medicine? I'm not sure. You know, you sit there and you, I'm stunned. I will say this, though. The reason why Jensen's doing this is because Gazelka and Benson have gotten in the race. And he's basically out-loonballing everyone else on the right. He is that group of people that Cheney welcomed in 2004, I was talking about earlier this hour. that group of people that's been incubated, that basically, you know, that the Republicans have been saying Democrats are evil, Democrats are evil, Democrats are evil for 20 years, blaming everything from 9/11 to Ebola to hurricanes to, you know, the pandemic on Democrats. And even when they can't find enough, they start making crap up. That those people are the main deciders when it comes to the caucuses and the primary. And they know it. And Jensen knows it. And so he's basically saying to Gazelka and Benson, oh, you think you're going to take a right-wing swing? Well, let me tell you how right-wing I'm going to. I'm calling for civil disobedience. I'm calling for a public uprising. Jeez. And like I said, God forbid some clown that follows Jensen walks into a school and starts shooting the place up. God forbid. Well, I never meant for violence to happen. I was just saying we need to have a better discussion about things. No, you're not. You're calling for civil disobedience, jackass. But the reality is Jensen seems to have a pretty decent idea of exactly how you're going to win the GOP nomination. It will spell doom for the Republican Party overall in 2022 if this guy is your nominee. That's why my guess is going to be is the Republican money people are going to wait to see which one, Gazelka or Benson, is resonating better, and then basically tell the one who's not working, get out of the way so we can basically just throw everything we have at the other person so they can win. That'd be my guess. But the reality is that Jensen knows who's electing GOP officials right now. And, you know, I'm sure he's not even thinking about how, if he does become the general election person, how he's going to defend statements like this. Oh, I never said that. Who said I said that? You guys are liars because I never said that. And of course, isn't that kind of the Republican thing? I'm a hypothetical of how he could defend it. It's a hypothetical. But dear Lord, the rhetoric coming from Jensen right now, yeah. He's the doctor, and I'm the one saying, I want you to get healthy and stay safe. And he's the doctor out there saying, no masks, no vaccines ever. And you need to go out there in civil disobedience. What does that mean? Ripping off people's face masks? Dragging children out of schools? What does that mean? Wow, Jensen. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. These are crazy freaking times, aren't they? We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Jensen's own tweet where he announces, I mean, listen how crazy this guy sounds. Minnesota must become a health freedom sanctuary state. Ban on vaccine passports. Ban on employer vaccine mandates. Banishment of child masking. Is he saying that even if I want my own child to have a mask, or if my child has a health condition where a mask is needed, that they should not be able to have a mask? Because that's what it sounds like he's saying. Banishment of child masking. Ban on emergency lockdowns without exceptions. Oh, that's good. So that basically, if we have another variant of coronavirus that comes out that's actually killing, say, 50% of the population, that there's not going to be an emergency lockdown. We have to keep the Chili's open. Really? The tyrannical top-down approach from Biden must be met with a strong rebuke. Meet the moment! He's basically, yeah, he's calling for civil disobedience, as the Star Tribune says. This is Leah Greenside, who's a PhD. Scott Jensen's language is getting increasingly dangerous. How does he still have his medical license? On top of that, last week, she adds this. Last week, an anti-mask father screamed at my child's principal on the first and second days of school. It was very traumatic for the kids, parents, and teachers who witnessed, and the police had to be called. Scott Jensen's rhetoric is empowering people like that, and I am concerned. You should be concerned. I would be very concerned. Even Broadcorp is saying the next engaged at this, and Michael Broadcorp once again was on the show yesterday. Excellent interview. And, you know, like I said, he's a Republican. And he's even saying the next enraged or crazed person who storms into a business or school to complain about using masks to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 may be there because of Dr. Jensen's dangerous rhetoric. He goes on to say, to me, it sounds like Dr. Jensen is calling for another insurrection. Jensen's rhetoric is incendiary. It does. I mean, I don't know. How else do you can take this? Because he doesn't seem to be toning down. And what is this, you know, preventing anyone from being able to wear a face mask? Any child? Seriously, there are a lot of kids with health issues that need to be wearing a mask. And are you saying no? What kind of doctor are you? I mean, he is selling his, he seems to be selling his soul for the GOP nomination. He seems to be selling his soul. And like I said, politically, I understand why he's doing this. You have Gazelke, you have Benson coming into the race this week. I get that. I understand. He's basically trying to solidify his base. He doesn't want any of the crazy train right going anywhere but to him. And he knows that that's who gets Republicans nominated at this point. But I mean, it to actually have a governor's candidate say, "I want you to engage in civil disobedience. I want you. It's time for you to stand up. It's time for you to make your voice be heard." Dear God, we're going to have someone get attacked. We're going to have people get injured. God forbid we actually have someone start shooting up a school. And then I can't wait for the, where did you get the idea I was putting out that kind of rhetoric? I don't know. You need to go check with yourself because it, you know, there seems to be not a lot of a clarity on what you're saying here outside of, hour two of the show, that's up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, small waist, pretty face, and a big bank. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on your Friday. Good to have you with us today. Yeah. Big bank. Matt Patrick here. Patrick, by the way, I do want to mention one thing. Many years ago, I was a marketing manager for a company called Blakeway Panoramas. And Jim Blakeway, who runs that company, actually took one of the most iconic pictures of the World Trade Center. The panorama, of course, it's a sideways panorama with the World Trade Centers. He took it, and it took it only a few months before the towers came down. It really is. It's one of the most iconic images from the World Trade Centers. It's also one of the more, it's got a lot of deep impact and stuff. If you need to see that, I worked with Jim for many years. He's a great guy. Blakeway Panoramas, local company. Go take a look at that. It is still one of their best sellers as far as people wanting to remember the World Trade Center. It's 20 years later, they have still been selling quite a few of those there, and it deserves to be because as an artist, it's just a magnificent photo of the World Trade Centers. Very tough. Once again, that anniversary tomorrow. I think the Star Tribune actually had an article in it where they said where they're going to have some services, memorial services. I have a friend whose son is married to a woman whose dad died on 9/11. And so they are out in New York for the ceremonies for that, and for all the people that lost people on 9/11. And, of course, the wars that we had afterwards, all my best. All our prayers for you guys. 952-946-6205. Patrick, where do you live? What suburb? Where in the cities? Where at?
I'm right here in Edina.
You're in Edina. Edina? Wait a minute. One of your people is living in our city? How dare you? How you get your vermin out. Out. Go. No. You can. This is not bad. This is bad for our image here. How dare you bring one of your people in here? All right, that aside, we all can agree this is a good thing. It's the final countdown. Tomorrow, the $239 million I-35W-94 construction project that began 4 years ago is just hours away from completion. The Minnesota Department of Transportation said recently they're going to be open today. They're going to open up early. All lanes, ramps, and bridges impacted by the project will be open on September 10th. Yes! Dear God, going out on a Friday or Saturday night and you have to get into the South Minneapolis at all, the 46th Street ramp? You're backed up like a mile there because it was the only ramp that was open all the way into the downtown. Oh, God. Oh, man. That is going to be nice. Let's see who tags it first. Let's see. You might as well just send one of the MnDOT guys out there just with a can of spray paint just to get it. Yeah, there it is. Done. Thank you. Kilroy was here. Who could have ever guessed?
I did notice, must have been about a couple months ago, when that the new ramp they were building from North 35W to West 94, that had already been tagged even, you know, months before it opened.
Hey, some of that stuff is good, man. There's one that's out by the tunnel, the Lowry Hill Tunnel. Bravo! Get that kid a canvas, or more, you know, empty space. I think street art is magnificent. I think it's actually underappreciated, and I don't think it's nearly the menace that people think it is. But, you know, just don't as long as you don't have any junk in your in your images. You know, let's cut the swear words out and cut the, you know, anatomically correct images. Or if you want to do a picture of me, you know, there off you go, and then you can put swear words around that. Guess because that was what everyone will be saying if they see it. So the MnDOT spokesperson said that everything remains on track, everything will be open by 11:59 p.m. tonight. Who's waiting up? When work on the year-long project began in August 2017, motorists met with news of groans and dismay. MnDOT promised the work would improve the highway in numerous ways. Was it actually done? New concrete for stretches that was 50 years old. And by the way, when they tell you it's more cost-effective to do asphalt, no. Concrete is a by far better product to build roads with because it lasts for 50 years. You show me one asphalt road that lasts 4 years and you're having to repave it. No, concrete lasts, man. That's I learned those from my MnDOT days. Let's talk road construction. I can do that all day. Concrete is, and the reason why we don't have more concrete roads is because Republicans say it's too expensive, even though it lasts a long time. 11 bridges rebuilt, 4 bridges repaired. The construction on a brand new bus station at Lake Street. New access ramps from 35W South to Lake Street, 35W North to 28th Street. Easy pass lanes near the downtown. All you need now is cars that will use it. Hey, that was kind of a swipe. Wider, more accessible pedestrian bridges. Like I said, a big bank. And a rebuilt ramp from 35W North to 94 West that will reduce congestion and increase traffic mobility. That's that one that's the big bridge that's going to shoot off the highway there.
Yep, because originally it came in on the right where people were all panicking. We got to get over to 94. We don't want to get off at Hennepin because that lane
that's
got
right.
off.
That's right. And that was like a 12-foot access ramp. That's right. God, I'd forgotten that. That was a nightmare. You think it's bad coming 169 trying to take 212 off the crosstown? No, that you're right. That was like you've got 8 feet to get over. And, of course, no one was showing you respect at that point. Well, and so that's good. So that does come in on the left side, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And they said there was a dedicated lane through the tunnel because they studied it and they found that the vast majority of people going down that ramp were going to stay on 94. So that's why they moved it over away from getting off at Hennepin Lindale like that.
Well, thank God they're going to put a lot of slow traffic in the Lowry Hill Tunnel. Thank you, the gift that keeps on giving. I'm going to go out this week. I'm going to go head over there. I mean, for God's sakes, every other road in this damn town is being constructed on at this point. If you've got open ones, I'm all over that action. 952-946-6205. Hey, Brett Johnson's got one of his weekly interviews with us. Max Richtman, this is from the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. He's had him on every once in a while. He wanted to bring him on. There's some late new developments in regards to the fight for Social Security and Medicare he wanted to talk with Brett about. So, Brett Johnson, here's your special interview right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson back with you here on a Friday afternoon. Well, we're joined now by Max Richtman. He is with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Website is ncpssm.org. And as you can imagine, Social Security and Medicare are very important to protect in times like these amid the COVID-19 pandemic. And right now, we just had a new trustees report that was released on Social Security and Medicare that can give us a clearer picture on the funding status of both of those programs. And, of course, here to help us interpret that data is Max Richmond of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Hey, Max, how are you doing today? Thanks for coming back on the show.
Yeah, I'm pretty good. I appreciate the invitation.
Absolutely. So before we dive into the data and how the programs are looking in terms of their financial health, let's first at least talk about how Social Security is funded in the first place. I think that's always a good reminder for people to know how Social Security really is funded, if you can explain that.
Well, it's funded through the payroll tax. As most workers are well aware, when they receive their check, there's a deduction, a FICA, Federal Insurance Contribution Act, and that goes towards the Social Security program. That's the way it's been funded for many, many decades, and it's been a pretty successful program. As you know, it's Social Security, as you pointed out, is especially important now with the pandemic that we're living through, but it's always been important. And I think the fact that the program has been so successful in lifting more people out of poverty than all other federal programs combined is a good sign of why we need to make sure the program is sound, continues for many, many years to come. And I think that's where we need to start talking about the trustees report.
Yeah, so let's talk about what was in that trustees report for Social Security funding, because as I understand, it looks like we are going to pay full benefits until at least 2034, which seems like good news, being that we did have 1 year's loss of solvency during the COVID pandemic when of course we had that payroll tax holiday.
Exactly. And there, you know, it's no surprise to me, it should not be a surprise to anyone, that the solvency date, the year at which the program will no longer be able to pay full benefits, was moved up from 2035 to 2034, given the fact that so many people were unemployed, which means less money was going in through that payroll tax, the FICA tax we just discussed, and so many people decided to retire early because they needed the money. They needed to have some resources in the event that they did lose their job. So, you know, the fact that less money was coming in, more money was being paid out than had been anticipated a year sooner, it's clear that the result would have moved the projected date up from 2035 to 2034. It's remarkable to me that that's the only, and it's actually really not a whole year. It's about 8 months, but it's rounded off to a year. Now, what does that mean? Does not mean the Social Security program is bankrupt in 2034. It means that it will only be able to pay about 78% of the benefits that people are expecting. And that is a serious problem that needs to be addressed. But it's important that we keep in mind that the program will not be bankrupt. It won't be broke. There won't be zero money coming to beneficiaries. What needs to be fixed is that gap. And that's something that I think serious legislators, and I know many of them from your state, are committed to addressing.
So as we look at interpreting this information that we received from the trustees report, it sounds like this was better than you were probably expected, given what we had happened during the worst of the COVID-19 pandemic, that, well, this 2034 date probably better than it could have been.
Absolutely. I was concerned that it would be moved up even closer to the present than 2034. And again, I repeat, it's really 8 months rounded off to a year. So that's a pretty good sign of the strength of the Social Security program. Now, I'm not trying to minimize the fact that benefits will not be paid in full under the current trustees report after 2034. That's a serious problem, and I think most legislators feel that that has to be addressed, because, you know, every senator, every member of the House of Representatives has a lot of Social Security beneficiaries in their district. They vote. They keep track of the promises and the ways members of Congress follow through on those promises as it affects Social Security. And I don't think it would be irresponsible for the Congress not to start looking at ways to address that solvency issue. The longer we wait to do that, the closer we get to 2034, the more difficult it will be to make changes so that the program is solvent way beyond 2034. And there are some proposals in the Congress over the last year, a year and a half, and I think they'll be reintroduced in a couple of weeks that do address the solvency issue and also the adequacy of Social Security.
So while we do know that the program is going to be able to pay full benefits until 2034, which is certainly good news, that is still 13 years away. And as you were talking about, it is going to be a problem after 2034 where all of the benefits won't disappear, but we could start seeing those benefits begin to dwindle as the years go on. Do you feel like there's enough of an urgency within Congress right now? Because often when it comes to politicians, they think, well, 2034, that's 13 years away. I only need to worry about my next reelection campaign. So if we're good until 2030.
I hope that's not the way members of Congress view this issue. I think it would be irresponsible if that's the approach they took. I think most members of Congress realize that delaying taking any action means that whatever is done as you get closer to 2034 would have to be more drastic. The more time there is to phase in changes, the less difficult that becomes politically. And I have to say, I think there's a serious political risk for members of Congress who fail to recognize the importance of this issue and the importance of making sure the Social Security program remains solvent well beyond 2034.
And I think it's up to voters, too, to put voters on those to put pressure on those politicians, because I'm someone who's a millennial, and I know a lot of other younger people who either don't have any retirement plans or don't have anything saved in their savings account. I believe the latest data I saw was over half of all workers have no retirement plans at work. So really important to make sure we have that Social Security program funded into the future, as obviously millennials continue to age and generations after continue to age. They have to make sure that those funds are there, especially as more and more people don't have retirement plans at work.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. You know, 10,000 people turn 65 every day. 10,000 every day. So the program is going to have to be aware of the needs of all of these new people that enter the program. But I'm really glad you raised the issue of millennials, you being one, because what's often overlooked is that Social Security is only for seniors. In fact, 38% of Social Security benefits go to non-retired workers. I'm talking about disabled, survivors, spouses, children. I think 3.5 million children get by in life because they receive Social Security benefits if a working parent dies young or becomes disabled. So, you know, I mentioned the term FICA at the beginning of the interview. FICA stands for Federal Insurance Contribution Act. It funds old age survivor and disability programs. This is a program for families. As an example, I don't know how old you are, but a 27-year-old worker with a spouse and two children right now, never mind what happens when they turn 65 or 67, right now they have about $500,000 in value in life and disability insurance because of Social Security. And a lot of younger people aren't aware of that value until something bad might happen in the family and someone might say you ought to check into Social Security. There's some protection for your family. So it's insurance for families. Yes, it's very important for seniors, who so many of them depend on Social Security for all or most of their income, but it's also important for younger people, for families in general.
Speaking with Max Richman of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare website is ncpssm.org. I want to switch gears and talk a little bit about Medicare now. What do we know from the latest report on Medicare funding? Because as I understand it, Medicare Part E was unchanged but solvent only for the next 5 years. So how should we interpret the funding of the current funding status with Medicare right now?
Well, the Medicare Part A Trust Fund, according to the latest trustees report, will be depleted in 2026. That's not that far away. That is, you pointed out, that's unchanged from last year, and that's about what we thought we would be seeing. And at that time, again, does not mean Medicare won't exist. Medicare will still cover after 2026 without any changes in law about 91% of the cost that the program will incur. So that date is something that has to be very closely watched. One of the things that we have been working on is a way to save Medicare money, provide funds perhaps for other benefits that are not included in Medicare. And I'm very encouraged that we've seen in the last few days more information coming from the Biden administration and from members of Congress that there will be a strong effort in the legislation we're going to be seeing in the next couple of weeks to address the high cost of prescription drugs. If Medicare had the authority to negotiate for the best price for prescription drugs for Medicare beneficiaries, the savings are in the hundreds of billions of dollars. I've seen figures of about $450 billion over 10 years. So we need to start, I think, looking at ways to reduce the cost of the Medicare program, and this is a very important part of that, bring more revenue into the program. What we have been working on for a number of years is trying to expand Medicare benefits. If we could save that much money on the cost of prescription drugs, some of it could be applied towards adding dental, vision, and hearing coverage to the Medicare program. I meet so many people at town hall meetings around the country that I've been waiting for a dentist or an audiologist or an ophthalmologist until they turn 65, assuming Medicare will cover those costs, but it doesn't. That's really a shock to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I think there are ways to bring the cost of the Medicare program under control. Part of it, as I mentioned, is giving the Medicare program the authority to negotiate the best price for prescription drugs. And some of those savings could be applied towards improving the benefits that I just mentioned.
And final question/topic for you here, Max. There's lots of movement going on right now with the Democrats' infrastructure bill in Congress. Lots of moving parts in terms of the size and scope of that bill, where most Dems want that bill to be about $3.5 trillion, while other moderate Democrats would like to see that scaled down. But from at least what you've seen in the infrastructure bill and the different proposals, what kind of impact would it have on our social safety net programs like Social Security and Medicare? Because important to point out, that infrastructure bill would do a lot more than just build roads and bridges. It really would help with our social safety net.
Absolutely,
as well.
Especially when it comes to health care. I think that what we're tracking very closely is improvements in the providing health care, especially through the Medicare program, making sure that community health care coverage is adequate, that nursing home coverage and home care is adequate. There's some significant proposals in that legislation that would deal with that. And on top of that, there's what we've been very focused on is family leave components of the legislation that would bring more the ability for people to help take care of their children or an elderly parent and have some financial security while doing that. So it's you said there are a lot of moving parts. They're moving so fast that it's pretty hard to keep track of it. But I'm hoping that at the end of the day, there will be enough support to get these improvements in the Medicare program. And Social Security legislation is being developed on a separate track. And the one thing I just would mention is the proposal that I think has the most support right now that addresses both the solvency issue that we've been discussing and the adequacy of benefits, improving the benefits, which I'm sure you know are pretty modest as it is, that those proposals are focused on changes in that the payroll tax that I mentioned. Right now, and it's been the case for many years, there's a cap on wages subject to the payroll tax. It changes a little bit every year. This year, it's about $148,000 a year in wages. After that, no more payroll tax. Why? We would support eliminating that cap. That would bring in enough revenue to improve benefits, improve the minimum benefit, improve the cost of living adjustment, inflation adjustment annually, and bring in enough revenue to extend the solvency. Politically, removing that cap is probably not realistic. What's more likely is keeping the cap at what it is and then starting to collect payroll taxes at $400,000 in wages and above. I think there's a lot of support in the Congress for doing that, and it is consistent with President Biden's pledge not to raise taxes on anyone earning less than $400,000 a year. So I'm pretty hopeful that the infrastructure, the human infrastructure that we talked about, the changes in Medicare's ability to negotiate for the best price for prescription drugs, and an adjustment in the cap on wages subject to the payroll tax will mean positive things for both Social Security and Medicare, and therefore for American families.
Absolutely, and you are totally right on raising that cap for Social Security taxes. It's crazy that hasn't happened yet, but as you said, maybe we can gradually begin to lift that cap so higher income people end up paying more into the Social Security program.
Well, what's interesting is if we start again at $400,000, as I said, the cap changes, it goes up a little bit every year. Over time, there will be no cap because it will move towards that $400,000. That's going to take a while, but that would be the end goal.
Gotcha, yeah, and hopefully we can get there sooner rather than later. Hey, we've been speaking with Max Richmond of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, talking a little bit about the infrastructure bill and also the solvency of both programs, being that we just had that trustees report released. And you can find more information about that and ways you can help protect Social Security and Medicare over at the website ncpssm.org, ncpssm.org. Max, as always, appreciate the time. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you very much.
Let's take a break and send things back to Matt McNeil on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Ghostbox Radio is on the air with us on the weekends. If you're not listening to it, it's actually absolutely a fantastic show. 4 p.m. on Sunday, they re-air it on Saturday nights. Greg Bakken is the host of that show. He's kind enough today to join us, talk about his upcoming show, but I got to talk to him first about some things I experienced in South Carolina. Greg, how are you, my friend?
Matt, it's good to hear from you. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I was in South Carolina. And I went down and visited my mom, and this was earlier in August, and I did a ghost tour, okay, and this was one of the ones where I hike around, and this is in Beaufort, and it's easy to kind of pull off a tour like this. You can just do a walking tour. It's actually quite pretty, a lot of great houses down there still. It's tropical, so you got palm trees and lots of pretty flowers, but it was one of those that the tour guide had this box that she was carrying that at various points some grumblings come out of the box, and she said, well, that's the ghosts. And, you know, it was kind of one of those things where you'd hear there, well, yes, my dress is pretty. And you know, you couldn't understand and comprehend what the thing was saying, but she was having conversations with it. Have you ever heard of people doing that? And is it work? Because to me, it seems like, especially when you're walking through a city, other things that could interfere with something like that.
Right, and that's the funny thing about it is that, and without me seeing what this person was doing, it's kind of hard to comment, but it sounds like that it might be something that is a little bit, I don't know, a little suspect, right? The first thing that comes to mind when I hear you tell that story is a psychic medium, tarot card reader, Anne, who's, I know she's listening, and she does, took part in a ghost walk in Tombstone. It was kind of the same sort of thing that they were, like, pointing stuff around, like, I think it was like a temperature gauge or something, and they're pointing it like up at the air and like, see how cold it is on the temperature gauge? That's a ghost. It's like, well, no, it's cold out. You know, it's like you're shooting it in the air away from everybody else. So it's not exactly, you know, it's not exactly scientific. And I think one of the things that's kind of sad about all this is that I think people want to be more entertained. Like, they're going on these walks thinking it's like the Haunted Mansion of Walt Disney World, opposed to it being like something that maybe we might get something, maybe we won't. But like you said earlier, you're in a very beautiful place. It shouldn't really matter if we get like a spirit interaction or not, because you're in one of the most beautiful places on Earth, which, by the way, I saw those pictures, and truly amazing.
Yeah, gorgeous. A gorgeous area. And it brings up, and of course it is the South, which brings up another problem with this ghost tour, is that you can't, and this is, I think, and maybe this is just a product of our modern day, is that it clearly the mentality was, oh, let's go talk about these friendly white ghosts. And it was these white ghosts that were there, you know, that were all friendly and all these things, you know, kind of Casper-esque, I guess. And kind of thing. But I mean, there definitely was a narrative, and not just in the ghosts that we were supposedly encountering or hearing about, which were pretty much predominantly white, and, you know, had some kind of, you know, kind of meandering Southern story, but the way as well it was portrayed, that the people, how these people supposedly became ghosts, like the people that double crossed the Native Americans down there. And the Native Americans like, okay, no, we're not going to be slaves for you people. And they fought back. But the way it was presented was, oh, well, the brave villager stood up to the Native Americans. I said, dude, I'm on the Native American side on this one. You double-crossed them with the sail and then told them they could be your slave. I don't blame them for the ass-kicking you just got.
Well, and as far as I know, and maybe someone can correct me, I think the way that you become a ghost is by dying, and that's something that we all do anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's funny how people skew stuff so that it either becomes more tries to become more frightening, or you know what it's like, Matt, when people are taking stuff in and creating an agenda out of it and trying to create like their own sort of history of it, and you go to so many of these places that are quote haunted, that you go there and you stay there because it's haunted, and how many times you go there and they have that one ghost, that one named ghost that everyone thinks is the only thing that haunts that location, and they listen and they'll, you know, you go to the rooms and they keep like talking in the air for like, Sarah, can you hear me, Sarah? And it's like, there's probably a lot of different spirits in these places. It's not just Sarah, if Sarah even existed to begin with.
Mm. And you bring up a good point. It's like, you know, it's as they're going through the ghost and white ghost. Okay, you're telling me that there aren't any African American ghosts here? Because I can tell you what, if the way that the spirit gets imbibed on an area is true, a horrific death. Let me tell you a little bit about how many horrific deaths the African American community had in these communities. And my guess is that there are a ton of African American ghosts if this is real that's going on. And yet those stories, they never come to light.
No, and we actually had an investigation that we did back in December of 2020 that we went to a place in Minnesota here over by not too far actually from the Wabasha Caves, and once again, Anne was with us, and she was channeling and stuff, and she picked up a great deal of slaves, actually, because this house of all places, that you would never expect it to be anything that have to do with the Underground Railroad, but you look, and it had a bunch of underground, tunnels that were created and then a new house put on top of it. And so, you know, she was able to bring them through. And, you know, that's, you know, it's interesting because there wasn't like an agenda for her to find it. She went to location, we went to location, and the evidence presented itself to us. And that from there, we could try to figure out what was going on and, you know, not create a story that, you know, that a lot of these places tend to do.
Well, and I think it's just it you know, what you just said there. I mean, my goodness, there's something that then history backs up, and you create by doing more research on the house. Okay, now it makes sense why this is there, as opposed to just kind of going down the street. Now, I'm going to be blunt. I mean, clearly this was one of these haunted tours where, you know, it was more about just, you know, get the locals in, get the tourists in here, get them a few bucks, and that's fine. And like I said, it was a lovely walk, although God awful hot that night. But I will say I did have one creepy thing happen, okay? I had my cell phone. I was taking a picture. They actually, after the Native Americans kicked their butt justifiably, they came back to try to settle the area. And some of the houses they built, one of the first houses they built, actually still stands there. And it has the turret holes like you would see on a military fort, so they could stick a gun out of the basement and fire it. And I was by this. I wanted to take a picture of that, and my phone died on me in a very weird way, which it's never had. And of course, that was the ghost of the child. What child? You never went, what child are we talking about? You never said a kid was around here. But all of a sudden, there was a mysterious kid that, who, even though they died in the 1700s, understands iPhones and shut mine down. I didn't appreciate that.
No. And especially, and I do go to places where, you know, you feel like the energy is getting zapped out of a lot of different electronic devices. You know, the idea there is that, you know, spirits want to get some energy and they get power and stuff. And what we do as investigators is, like, when we're with groups of people, it's like, don't offer up your energy. Let them take it from the devices, because your energy is your own energy. The devices' energy, that's up for them to take, and maybe it helps them to communicate with us. I mean, it's a theory, right? It's not, you know, I try not to be like, oh, this is definitely how this works, but it is a theory that if they can take that energy, then it's easier for them to connect with us.
Greg Bakken's joining us. Ghostbox Radio is on Sundays at 4 o'clock. Robert Pilot, who's on right after me in the 6 o'clock hour, Native Roots Radio, I'm Awake. He actually, is he here? Okay, let's get Pilot on in here. Hey, Robert, how are you, my friend?
Hey, doing great. Love your show as always. What a great addition Ghostbox Radio has been to the AM 950 lineup. I just want to tell all my friends and relatives to listen up. I'm from the old days of Art Bell, and I just really love what you're doing, Greg. And all of my Native friends and relatives need to listen to you, because we all have these same stories going on. But you keep up the great work. I just wanted to jump in and say you're one of the best shows on AM 950.
Oh, gosh. Thank you so much. That's very kind of you to say. And, Robert, we do need to get you on at some point. There's a lot to talk about. So, yes, thank you so much.
Well, Robert, what's your best ghost story? Do you have one that's a really good one?
Not really. But, you know, if you watch Reservation Dogs, which is on, they're talking about a lot of the – they're different for different tribes, because we talk about Sasquatch and we call it different things. But there is a theme between all the nations here in the United States with beings that show up when they want to. And we also, you know, we talk about the tricksters. We also talk about people that turn into animals. These are all things that we talk about around the campfire and in the round tent and things like that. But I don't have anything right now, but I just love your show, and I really, you know, think AM 950 should have you on a couple hours, and maybe at midnight too when it's scarier.
Oh, wouldn't that be fun?
Well, you know, maybe we should do a Halloween show with you. That'd be fantastic.
That'd be fun. I'll tell you what I'm doing on Halloween, and we're trying to do a Halloween show. Anae and I are going to be out in Connecticut over Halloween, and you know what we're going to see out there, Matt? We're going to meet the real Annabelle doll out there.
You are. I heard about this. Are you crazy?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes, I am, Matt. Thank you for asking.
I don't need to. Hey, we got Michael Myers here. He wants to sit down and have some coffee with you. No, I'm good. No, I don't need to see him. So, hey, Robert, thank you very much. I appreciate you stopping on by here.
Yeah, and Matt, thanks a lot, always for the shout-outs, and Greg, keep up the great work. AM950 is super proud of what you're doing, and thanks again, Matt.
No problem, my pleasure. Of course, Robert Pilot and crew coming up here at 6 o'clock. Just stay with us through the evening right here on AM950. Greg Bakken joining us, Ghost Box Radio. Let's actually talk a little bit about your show coming up. This is the reason I'm having you on. You have got, of course, the 20th anniversary of September 11th tomorrow. On Sunday, you have got a special guest that's coming in to talk on your show. Why don't you give us the details there?
Absolutely. This gentleman came to light to me many years ago. While I was watching another program, and he came. He was on. He was telling his story. His name is Joseph Laney, and Joseph was a New York City police detective sergeant, and he was assigned to the Fresh Kills landfill in Staten Island, New York, after the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center. And what he was out there for was to sift through all of the World Trade Center debris, including human remains, personal effects, planes, black boxes, all of that horrible, horrible stuff. And he has lots and lots of stories about just being there and what he had heard and seen, frightening, frightening stuff. But while he was there, he suffered a major, major heart attack, and he nearly died. And what ended up happening is, after having a near-death experience, he came back and he was enlightened. He was basically touched, if you will, with the gift of mediumship. And so he has turned himself into somebody who goes around and does mediumship for people, does readings for people. He works with a lot of people, and it's just a really interesting story. And you know, the thing that I really want to get out there, Matt, is the fact that I'm sure there's skeptics out there thinking that this is very insensitive to the memory of 9/11, but it's not. This is meant to be, you know, what one person did and how I believe that what had happened to him on Fresh Kills Landfill, which I can never get over that name, what happened to him, you know, it was a start of a new direction in his life. And so there's a lot to talk about there, and he is such a fascinating person.
Well, and you bring up his story, and I've heard this before, where people have had near-death experiences, and they come back, and we're not talking about you know people that you might say, okay, they're just looking for a new avenue. I mean, doctors, architects, professionals that will have this happen, and they come back and they say, the world is different to me now because of that being touched, and that they do seem to have some sort of ability that they did not have before. I've heard about that. I've read about that before. And it sounds like the same situation there. I mean, when you're talking about Mr. Laney, I imagine just as you're talking about this, the stories you could talk about just as they're bringing things in on 9/11 and be there and to have to be a witness to what he was seeing, regardless of what else he has to add. I mean, that alone is the provenance to listen to the show.
It is. And, you know, this Mr. Laney is one of those true blue, loves New York City. Just, you know, he immersed himself. And I mean, he is what you'd expect when you talk about a New York City cop. You know what I mean? It's just that gruff exterior, but, you know, really tender interior, cares a lot for people, you know, has to be, you know, very streetwise to what's going on and stuff. And you know, he loves New York. So, I mean, let alone the fact of how we all mourned and how we all were absolutely in shock and anger over what happened on September 11th. This is a person who lived in the city his entire life and, you know, looked at those towers every day and, you know, lived that existence. And so, you know, just that alone, like you said, outside of everything else, it's just going to be an interesting story. I've talked with him before. He is such an incredibly kind person. And I think everyone's going to really find something with what he has to say on Sunday.
Sunday, 4 o'clock, re-airs next. Well, you'll have a re-airing up on this Saturday night, but that episode specifically will air the following Saturday as well. One final thing I want to get into. So you're going to go see this Annabelle doll.
I sure am.
Where is this at?
There's actually a paranormal convention in Waterbury, Connecticut that Tony Spera is putting on. And Tony is the son-in-law to Ed and Lorraine Warren, who, for those of you will probably know their names as the two main characters in the Conjuring films, but it's real. They are real people. They were demonologists. They have both passed along now, but the movies are being made based on their cases. And Tony Spera is their son-in-law and still keeps up the paranormal group out there, as well as all these different events. And what we're going to do when we go out there is there's literally going to be a meet and greet with Annabelle. She's in this case. You can't touch her. You can have your picture taken with her, but Elaine Warren herself, she was just like, I would never look in this doll's eyes because it would just, there's too much energy there. So I think you got to be a little careful, obviously, but you know, I might just take it out and give it a hug. I'm not sure.
Take a picture with it. They're like, yeah, I'm going to take a picture with that shark in the water. Let's see what happens here. Okay. So earlier this week, I was talking about the absolute crap film Polaroid from 2019, where apparently a demon spirit has been cursed himself to be in an antiquated piece of technology, a Polaroid camera. But of course, to move the plot forward, the Polaroid becomes the most popular piece of technology in the town in a modern day world. The idea of spirits being imbibed on a specific thing, if that's real, are there really like the laser disc ghost, the TiVo ghost, the 8-track tape ghost, these ghosts that are attached to antiquated pieces of technology where, you know, it's going to be a long time since anyone's going to be touching the 8-track tape ghost. Let's be honest about that.
I mean, I think my luck would be that I would like inhabit like an air fryer or something, you know, just something that, you know, like, no, I can't do anything with. I can't communicate with people about. I really can't say, like, you know, without, because, you know, it's like I'm not an expert in the field in the sense of being able to say for sure that a spirit can embody a piece of equipment. But what I think happens is that they are able to manipulate the energy. Mm-hmm. So, like, we always have the flashlights that we ask them to turn the flashlights on, and they do so. I've certainly had many people tell me that the TVs come on and turn off by themselves or switch to a certain channel all the time, and we can't figure out why that is. So I think that that's more what would happen. I think if a spirit, like, wants to live in a Polaroid camera, I just feel like that, you know, that they're kind of really missing out on all the possibilities of being a spirit. But, you know, that's their problem, I guess. I hope I choose better, Matt.
The ghost of the pager. Actually, I'm gonna be look for me in a shake weight. I think it's really appropriate if you think about it. Alrighty. Greg Bakken. We look forward. This sounds like an exceptional show coming up this weekend. It's exceptional every weekend you're on the air. But make sure you're listening in. Once again, Joseph Laney going to be joining him on Sunday, 4 p.m., Ghost Box Radio. Greg, I appreciate the time today. All my best. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
Thank you, sir.
Take care. We'll come on back. We'll round up the show for the week when we do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Thanks to Greg Bakken, as well as also thanks to Max Richmond joining us a little bit earlier. And Robert Pilot and crew, once again, they're up right after me, but it is a Friday. I want to get to it. Life in Sweatpants, great song. Good to Yourself is it's called. You have a great weekend. We are back on a Monday. Full week of shows next weekend as well, right here on AM 950.